Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
We had a wood stove, a toilet that worked only in the summertime, very little water.
I think of my journey as a bumpy ride.
Enough solar power to run my computer an hour a day.
And then going out into the parking lot, which was red clay, and just sitting there in the parking lot crying.
Bumpy ride.
And we had a phone in town, and the phone was in the back of the bakery, so you sat on the flour stacks as you talked.
And I was like, no, you don't understand. Let me tell my story again, because I usually get a different reaction.
Of course, you know, you don't know until you're on the other side of the hill what life looks like differently. Differently.
Welcome to Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
Coming to you from our back porch in Sebastopol, California. Usually we lock ourselves into our soundproof studio to protect you from the chickens and the neighbors and the traffic. But the chickens are benign and it's a beautiful day and you've heard traffic before, so we're out here.
We've got two trips today, and we might call them both trips of discovery. The first started out in Morrisville, Pennsylvania, and the second in West Africa.
Mark Cello lives in Maryland, wife and two kids, works at the Library of Congress, plays blues guitar. And I was interested in his story not because it was unusual, but because for me it reflected a very common experience. The aftermath of the blossoming of San Francisco subculture, this outward ripple into the backwaters that still lives in many hearts. In the summer of 1970, Mark and his mother drove cross-country, Pennsylvania, to San Francisco.
It was a very powerful transition moment in my life. I was 15 years old, and my parents were having troubles in their marriage, and my mother told my stepfather that she was quitting her job, and she was going to get her money and sell her Chevy Impala and instead buy a Volkswagen camper. And she told me, you have 2 weeks to say goodbye to your friends because we might not ever be coming back. So we left and we went drove across the country. It took us about 2 weeks. We stayed at Campground of Americas. And it was also just a time in my life when I was developing and encountering things. And it was wonderful. But really, some of the key insights and kind of key clumps of new realizations about the world for me did come together quite rapidly and intensely that summer. Lost my virginity, for example. I don't want to overplay that, but but lots of other stuff happened. It was about 4 months from late summer to, I guess it was August, September, October, November. And I came back to Morrisville, Pennsylvania, but it wasn't the same Mark. I, you know, having been hanging out in the hate and participating in what was really the kind of dregs of the kind of Golden Gate mid-60s Haight-Ashbury scene, nevertheless, compared to Bucks County, Pennsylvania, it was imbued with a kind of sort of a hippie ability, which I explored to the best of my ability, and I went native. And then when I returned to Asbury High, I hadn't cut my hair, which was, you know, of course, it wasn't all new. It's just, you know, it wasn't that I was completely like a clueless individual from a different planet. But suddenly I was in like the epicenter of the Amish followers, and from kind of being peripherally situated culturally, I was suddenly in an environment where I could get much more intuitive about that, although at the time I realized it was a lot different. It's more just making up the insanity from 75, just miles. And yet, I got something. I got the 1970, in other words, dog doo-doo on the sidewalks in the Haight, and lots of boarded up head shops, and lots of evidences of a subculture which had flourished and had now changed. And in a way, it's the Haight-Ashbury of 1970 felt sort of like a kind of a place where something big and really incredible had been going on, and now it was sort of like the morning after. And there are still lots of people that really dreamed the dream and continued to, and were like keeping the flame. And I was, you know, totally into throwing myself into that, into their world, not the cynics. I thought it was really too bad that whoever had that dog didn't care enough about the community to make sure that the poop was scooped. That, to me, was a really powerful kind of moment of saying, wow, the party's over. Because in the very first flowering of it, of the summer of love, there's a great amount of people going way out of their way to treat each other right and go a little extra distance in a way that couldn't possibly be construed as self-serving, but really was just a kind of community-oriented altruism filled with a lot of playfulness and joy. Yeah, we come back to Pensbury High, and I have an incredible amount of credibility now with some of my friends that before I was sort of struggling to attain to. Suddenly I had been to the big city, and so I kind of redoubled my efforts to kind of discover the spirit of it all and, you know, sniff a piece of it. It wasn't that I was interested in the trappings or impressing anyone else in an external way, but I really was very invested in, I think, the idea, what we might call the ideology of it all. I had caught this bacillus, and the trip to California reinforced, because it was sort of like going to the Capitol, where, you know, everything you already kind of knew about and thought was cool, you get the stamp of, like, yeah, you've actually arrived at some kind of landmark. But I really, when I came back, I was trying to take the spirit of it inside me and to not lose some of the germinal impulses. But I had read enough material that described the same scene that I really, you know, was filled with all these stories of the pranksters and acid tests and, you know, what was going on in 65 in San Francisco and all this. And I guess I really kind of felt that it was something that was worth getting to the pith of and trying to get something out of that would be of value. The community element of it was fascinating. The kind of cooperatives and the commune phenomenon and lots of alternative ways of living a life, but they were things that proved relatively durable over the subsequent decades, and it was a kind of, I guess, a sense of we together can make something marvelous happen. It seems very overinflated to say that it was any kind of rite of passage, because that's just been laid out anthropologically as really being an absolutely crucial reconfiguration of a person's consciousness. So to cop that for this, which is basically just some middle-class kid, you know, drove out to California, was there for a couple months and wasn't sure if his parents were going to get back together, and then they did, and then he returns. That's not what I call exactly heroic adventures, but when one is 15 years old and gets to that point where his mind is ready to go in 12 or 1,200 different places that it just wasn't quite ready for before, but all of a sudden one day you wake up and everything looks different, and it all kind of integrated and melted together to a certain degree.
At a noisy campground in New York State, we were talking with Mark Cello.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. And we'd like to hear your stories, discoveries, surprises. Visit our website, www.independenteye.org, where you can also listen to past shows and send us an email. Discoveries.
Yeah. Well, second only to the first trip to the maternity ward, it was the time we went first to Europe with, the pup tent that we'd never set up before, and the sleeping bags and our stuff stuffed into a pair of saddlebags that we put on an ancient motor scooter that we got in London, got it out of town and promptly broke down all over Europe and learned how to ask for help in a lot of different languages. And I think what it mostly taught me was I don't have to be protected from the world. I can cope, and I can love doing it. And we came back and we took our lives in our own hands and changed them permanently.
And this is our next story. We were at the reception for a huge university theater conference in Chicago, and I started talking to a young professor who turned out to be from West Africa, Cameroon. About a year later, I caught up with him. He's teaching at the University of Southern California. And between phone calls and incursions by young daughters, we talked.
I was born and grew up in Cameroon in West Africa. Did my first degree in Cameroon. Also did a graduate degree as well in Cameroon, studying English. I also studied literature and theater and stuff like that. I was also an actor for the stage and screen in Cameroon before I left. I won a scholarship, which sent me to England in the second half of the 80s. And then in England, I did a master's in theater, and then I completed a PhD in African studies, believe it or not, studying African studies in England.
Then he came to the U.S., taught in Washington, D.C., then to Western Kentucky, then to California. So the obvious theme is culture shock, or a whole life of culture shock.
Yeah. I grew up in the city as a kid in Africa. My dad used to work for the government. My mother used to be a teacher, but I will say the last 8 years of my life in Cameroon before leaving, I spent with a late uncle who had retired and had moved back to the countryside, to the country where he lived. And the cities in Africa, in a certain sense, at least in Cameroon, are no different from the cities here. These days, if you go back home, you would meet kids who don't speak an African language. They either speak French or English, period. They didn't know anything about the village. But I just had the interest in understanding who I was, you know, what my roots were. Especially growing up, and when I grew up, I could speak only one language very fluently, believe it or not, in Cameroon, and that was English. I could not speak my own language. We used to have trips with the family once in a while. We'll go there. But it was like there were just trips which sometimes we didn't even want to go because we were thinking, what are you going to do in the village, for Christ's sake? You know, because I wanted to play soccer, you know, or listen to... We didn't have TV in those days, but if the team was playing, we had all this live commentary on radio. So we'd want to listen on radio with our friends rather than go to the village and probably work on a farm or something, which we didn't like. But sometime in the, I would say late 70s, early 80s, I went on my own. I actually told my dad I was going to the village. The same way he looked at me. I was about 14 or 15 at the time. I went on my own. And for the next 7 or 8 years, it became normal. In fact, I didn't see my dad that often. Because I was in high school and then went to university. And this was like far away from where my parents were. So I just come in and see my parents for a day or two, and that's it. I leave and go to the village to be with my uncle. Like that, for 8 years, I go to the farm, learn the language, understood the history, and it was good. I liked it. It was, I wouldn't say easy. We used to like go, for instance, in the summer, we will go harvesting corn, and obviously, we don't have modern means of harvest like you have in the United States, so you have to do it by hand, and we'd load it in these big, huge bags and carry it on your heads for about 3 or 4 miles at a time, heavy. And so, God, those were hard days. And you'd be walking, and you'd walk through a fast-flowing stream which has no bridge. And for people like me who can't swim, you can imagine the water up to your neck in a bridge with a huge sack of corn on your head, bearing down on you, and but I'm still alive, as you can see. my little community in Cameroon is called Babanki. There are over 250 communities like this. There are only about 10,000 people who speak my language in Cameroon, a country of about 15 million, and that's it. My wife, whom you just met, and myself, she's from Cameroon as well, but she doesn't speak my language. She doesn't know anything about my language, but her community where she's from is only about 10 miles away from mine. I don't speak her language. No, the only way I communicate with my wife is English. So, these are the realities which we have to live with and deal with. But saying that still, if you came in here and you spoke Babangida, there's a certain kind of feeling that comes in and that's what I'm out for. That's why I feel it very strongly that I express myself as a Babangida person and as a Cameroonian and an African.
So how does it feel to leave behind a continent?
It was strong. It was a very strong feeling. I mean, landing in England and feeling the cold, which I'd never felt that kind of cold in my life. I didn't even know it existed. But in a sense, I felt it was quite positive. I just had the feeling that I was a person on a mission. But moving abroad, I felt like as if it was a detachment of my umbilical cord. But then again, among my people, we have a belief whereby when really not a belief, it's a part of us. When a child is born, the cord is cut and everything detached from the mother. The placenta is buried in the community with the belief that you will always be a member of that community. Now, in case you're born outside, say I have it, like my kids right now who are born here, you can't take a cold placenta to Africa to have buried. But more often than not, once the part of the navel, when it falls off, after you put it, and I will take it back home and I will bury it there, because that gives you a sense of belonging. It's a sense of finality and a sense of home. That's our belief structure. And so, although I was apprehensive about the world out there, one thing was certain. I knew exactly where my navel, as we say in my language, where my navel was buried. And I knew exactly what home was. And I knew exactly what home required of me. And therein lies my strength as well. To live out and face the dangers every day of living in America, of living in England, in Europe when I was a student, and of pursuing what I think is my own lifelong pursuit.
And then to America.
I think I was struck, first of all, by how big everything is in the United States. The cars were incredibly big, the roads were big, the people were big, the fruits I ate were big, the food was huge, the TV screens were big, the flowers were big, the apples were big. Everything I saw was big. I had to fall back on my basic principles, which is, where is your navel buried, Martin? And I had to fall back on that to relieve my own personal experiences and then to be able to face America, because it is a big country. When I was a member of faculty at George Washington University, Washington, D.C., which is just a block or two from the White House, I thought, well, I have 3 or 4 hours to burn before my next class. I'd take a walk down this road. As I walked down, I saw a police car in the middle of the road, a policeman leaning on it nonchalantly. Curiosity pulled me closer. And guess what? It was the White House. I didn't know my university was that close to the White House. And so I was walking by the White House, looking at the White House. Although I was looking at it, I wasn't actually seeing it. I was thinking more about this person who grew up in this little town in Africa, in Cameroon somewhere, from the village of Babangida and the rocks of Babangida somewhere, and how far this person has come and is working in a university that is close to probably the most powerful house in the world. And I had all these thoughts going on in my mind, and I wasn't looking at where I was going. And if you've seen pictures of the White House, or if you've been there, they have this like concrete slabs about this tall that mark the entrances where the cars go in and out. And I walked right into one of them. Should I say, it kind of hurt in the most sensitive part of the male anatomy. And I tried to be like a man and just take it, but I couldn't because it really hurt. So I went down on all fours, and the guards were laughing. And then I turned and told him, you know, I was actually admiring your country when I walked into that. Do you know that? And they kind of stopped, but you could tell I had made their day. And they came over and gave me a hand.
He talked about his kids, wanting them somehow to share in both cultures as he had, and how they might relate to the village and what that all meant.
But one thing is clear, now I feel comfortable. I can feel comfortable sitting here and telling you, you know, if you go among the Barwanki people, just a little community of 10,000 people, and you call my name, they'll know who you're talking about. My kids can go there and live there. We know your dad. You know, your dad used to do this here. And they'll take my kid, period. Now, they don't know much. All they care about is their basic survival. And that's what they'll see in the kid. Oh, I could send them there and they'd stay there for a year. I'm fine. I wouldn't break sweat. I wouldn't lose a hair. You know, I'll know they're fine and I'll be fine. And then this is the community thing. And you notice that among Africans. You notice that among African Americans. So these are those parts of the continuity that I'm talking about here, that I'm saying is innately a part of being black.
He hasn't been back to Cameroon. Now he expects to, as part of a project at USC to develop an interchange around the use of theater to build community.
I have been, and I will be, focusing on community work because I feel that my prerogative and job is to help others as much as I can.
Daddy.
Yes, you need to hear. Okay. Close yourself up. Go and see mommy. You hear?
Okay, Daddy.
Good girl.
When I finish doing your work, you go up there and take my clothes.
Okay, girl. Sorry about that. Yes, that's how I found myself here in California, University of San Carlos, with the School of Theater, where I teach various courses in theater. And my specialty, which is community theater and what we call theater for development, which is in essence in third world or developing countries, we want to tend to use theater to encourage people to be able to fend for themselves. I'll give you an example, for instance. You could come to a little village somewhere in Cameroon which doesn't have water or doesn't have a health center, and you want, you know, with them to be a health center, or you want pipe on water or something, and you use theater for that, to galvanize people into action, to build that little health center that they will then use, you know, for their own good. You see, we are talking about a country where over 250 different languages are spoken. So you will have, there's a lot of political problems in the country. There's a lot of social problems, economic problems. I mean, I think the average person in dollars makes about maybe $2, maybe $3 a day. And so people are concerned more with that kind of surviving as opposed to all the problems that develop out of the securities, what I may call the security of life. You know, if you were looking for underwear and you get underwear, it will end there. You'll look for a shirt. If you get a shirt, you'll want pants, you know. And if you have that, you'll want socks and shoes. And then when you get that, then you start looking for stuff like hats and then a watch. But when you are in a problem where the basic issue is that you want underpants, that's what you want. Because it becomes more complex when you have everything. You say, oh, don't, now I need to change my watch because I need a gold watch. And that's a problem. But those are not the kind of problems in Cameroon. The problem is, I'm not even thinking about a watch in the first place. I want underpants. And so with the theater out there, concerns itself with these issues. It concerns itself with the quest of people trying to get these basic necessities. And so to divorce theater from social action is almost near to impossible in Cameroon. Success success for me, I measure in terms of how many people feel happy about an achievement. What I will call success is if I step out here now and I have 10, 20, 30 friends writing to me from home and managed to send $50, and then they said, you know, we did this and this person drank water from a tap we set up for the $50 you sent, and part of the other 50, somebody bought a book and 10 students read that book, and we used the other one to buy some food and it fed X number of people. Now that's what I call success.
In Los Angeles, we were talking with Professor Martin Fusi.
And that's our trips for this week. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map, a production of The Independent Eye, written and hosted by us, obviously. Music and engineering by Elizabeth Fuller. For CDs of our shows, or to listen to past shows, or to contribute stories, visit our website at www.independenteye.org. And if you like the show, please call the station and let them know.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And this is Conrad Bishop offering a disclaimer. Just a general disclaimer. We just don't feel like being very responsible for anything today. We'll take on our normal burden of guilt next time. Okay?
There are things that happen here every day. There are people I meet, the good people, the bad people, the ugly people, but you meet that everywhere. I find Americans still the most fascinating people. I honestly do. Maybe I've been blessed with meeting the right Americans, I don't know. Or maybe I've been blessed with meeting the wrong Americans, I don't know. But some of my best friends, if not my best friends at the moment, are Americans.